The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from Master Dogen's 300 koan, Shobogenzo. Changsha's returning to mountains, rivers, and the great earth. The main case. So Master Changsha was once asked by a student, how do you turn the mountains, rivers, and the great earth and return to the self? Changsha said, how do you turn the self and return to the mountains, rivers, and the great earth? That Roshi's commentary. Responding to the myriad things from the perspective of the self is delusion. Manifesting the self from the perspective of the myriad things is enlightenment. From ancient times to the present, people have regarded the myriad things as separate from themselves, not realizing that the universe is the body of the Buddha, this body and mind itself. What do you see when you behold the mountain? Do you see the real form of truth? What do you hear when you listen to the river sounds? Do you hear the subtle gathas of rock and water? Or are you caught in the surface of sound and form? Mountains, rivers, and the great earth are ceaselessly manifesting the teachings, yet they're not heard with the eye, they're not heard with the ear, or seen with the eye. They can only be perceived with the whole body and mind. Be that as it may, how do you turn the self and return to the mountains, rivers, and the great earth? What is it that you are calling mountains, rivers, and the great earth? Indeed, where do you find yourself? Dada Roshi came to these mountains to establish his monastery, having spent many years camping, canoeing, loving these mountains and also the mountains of the Adirondacks. And so his dream, was to be able to establish a monastery in these very mountains. And then the Mountains and Rivers Sutra teaching of the Dogen became one of his most beloved teachings. And his bringing that into our training in terms of being aware of the earth, our human impact on it, all the trouble we're causing the earth. That initially was what he called training. He called being born as the earth. To be born as the earth itself. To not see ourselves as separate entities. So this koan kind of brought me to it as we're in our 45th year celebrating. The teachings often speak of turning what appears before us rather than being turned, that we get turned around by things. In the Surangama Sutra, the Buddha said, beings disregard their true selves by clinging to external objects and missing their Buddha mind. They're being turned around by objects. If they turn objects round instead, they will be like the Buddha, and their bodies and minds will be in the state of radiant perfection. So here Changsha says, turn the self and return to the mountains and rivers and great earth. The Buddha said, if they turn objects around, then they will be like Buddhas. So are these in conflict? How do we get turned around by things? Well, Dada Roshi asks, what are things? So mountains, rivers, and the great earth represent mountains, rivers, and the earth, but also everything, anything, everything, every phenomenon, anything you can touch, smell, look at, hear, think, the world of phenomena. There's no question that we do get turned around by things. We're affected, influenced, overwhelmed, seduced, deceived. Right? How are we deceived by something that doesn't have a mind, it doesn't have a plan, it doesn't have any consciousness? How are we deceived by it? Well, that's just language. How do we deceive ourselves? How are we deceived in experiencing something? To be deceived is to not see something clearly, but to see something and see it in a different way. So delusion is living in a world where we're experiencing the world in a way that seems very real to us, inarguably real. And then we try and live in accord with what we see, what seems to be real. But if that was real, if we were doing that, then everything should be good, better, great, harmonious, enlightened. Words, images, ideas, people, situations. So what the Buddha realized, and doesn't take a lot of inquiry or examination, doesn't require Buddhism for us to see that we bring our history, our assumptions, our beliefs, expectations, desires, fears. And we can learn from that, right? It shows us what in Buddhism we call the self. And Buddhism, you know, it's not a proprietary thing. The self exists in every place, in every person, in every religion. The sense of someone, the sense of a person, a personhood. And so as we're studying the self, as we're seeing the self arise through those assumptions and associations and tendencies and so on, that's showing us where our karmic entanglements are that we want to untie. They're showing us the sources of our own pain and unhappiness. And I think if we think of every attachment as being, in a sense, misguided response, misguided, based in misguided understanding. But at the heart of it, I think most of the time, there's something that we want that's actually good. We're just not going about it in a way that's going to yield good. I was reading recently where a scholar who was talking about the evolutionary aspects of some of our basic impulses. So he said, like hunger. So when our ancestors were just living out there, right, like every other creature, and not knowing where their next meal came from, then it made sense whenever you had food to eat as much as you could, because you don't know when you're going to eat again. And so if that's true, seems logical, then that impulse, right, to fill oneself to capacity, beyond capacity, makes sense. It's part of our survival. But then what happens when that impulse gets placed in a time and place where we have many people, not all, but many people have, in a sense, unlimited access to food? Then there can be overeating, right? Not eating in accord with hunger and not eating in accord with what's needed. He talked about boredom, that when the mind becomes bored, right, it's sort of a dull, lifeless state, that we seek some sort of movement, something to change, some shift, some stimulation. That too, he said, might be a survival mechanism. So we don't get lulled into, you know, a dull state that, and then suddenly we're in the jaws of some big four-legged, right? I mean, think about even domestic cats, dogs, you know, they sleep, but they're awake in an instant, right? And it's like there's a part of their mind that is always awake, right? That has not been lulled into a sense of absolute safety. And so in that way, that boredom can bring us into something, into change, to respond to our situation. But how does that manifest in current times? As restlessness, as agitation, as always seeking something new, something faster, something louder. Attachment is a bias, right? It's having a bias towards our desires, we could say, what we think we want, what we think we don't want, but it really, underneath that, it's a bias towards a self. It's a kind of prejudice, it's a projection based on false assumptions. And they're very powerful. They function, they compel us. They seem to demand of us that we respond to them until that begins to shift, right? And so when we're sitting, we're encountering those impulses all the time. But as the Buddha said here, so you resist the impulse to deny it or avoid it or shut it down, go dead. But on the other hand, we're trying to resist the impulse to get excited and agitated. And in that, there's a calming. I was thinking of this as a couple weeks ago, I went to have lunch with an old friend. It was raining. We were going to go for a walk, so I took my rain jacket. And when I came back, a couple days later, it was raining. I was looking for it. I couldn't find it. So I called up my friend and said, "Did I leave it in your car?" So he went looking. He came back. He said, "I did a thorough search of the car. It's not in the car." I said, We went out to eat. So I called the restaurant. Was it at the restaurant? They did a thorough search, came back quite a while later. "No, we looked everywhere. We can't find it." "Okay, thanks." So I thought, well, it's got to be somewhere. Last week, I was coming in early to sit in the morning, and I saw this crumpled piece of clothing. You already know where this is going. Sitting on the hearth. And I thought, who left that there? Right? It's a common space. Come on, people, take care of your stuff. Put it away, right? And so I went up to the Dokusan room. Next morning, I came in, there it is again. I'm thinking, oh, okay, this is like too much. Maybe I need to say something, remind people to really take care of this space, of the space that we share together. Meticulous effort. So I went up to Dokusan room. I'm putting on my robes, and I thought, oh. And I went down. Sure enough, it was my jacket. Sweet justice. So those slightly negative thoughts that I had towards the resident Sangha, I apologize. But it's how the mind can get fixed, right, on a certainty. So that even when I'm seeing it, that's not mine. That belongs to somebody else. Even though I know it's lost, I left it somewhere. This would be a very likely place where I left it. Did that enter my mind? Nope. Not until I saw it again. Right? I mean, second time, okay. So it didn't take forever, but still. So that's where that bias actually changes what we see. Changes how we experience it. Changes what we think is true. And then we act on that. So I started to have, sort of irritated thoughts. Sloppiness, not taking care. Why is it important that we celebrate Juneteenth? It has been over and over and over and over again established there is no scientific, no genetic, no biological basis for discrimination based on race. And yet, it persists. In fact, it's, you might even say, on a comeback or coming forward. Fixed ideas that are based in our kleshas. There are rational arguments people can make, are making, have learned to do that without ever invoking racism. Framing in terms of freedom, something completely opposite. But what's really going on is they're just basic, deep emotional impulses, fear, anxiety, anger, hatred, greed. Nothing new. Nothing new at all. Nothing new in each of us when they arise. And the rationale and the justification and the explanations and then the policies and the rules and laws that flow from that, in a sense, are, I would say, window dressing, but they're much more consequential than that. But really based in a felt sense of something that is not being seen, not being examined. There's no intimacy. There's no taking responsibility. The easiest thing, until it's not, is always to externalize. You can't do that without a sense of self. That cannot happen without a very firm and well-established sense of self. And in the very instant when that arises, there is an other. It's not a question. It's not a debate. We don't need a study. The Buddha understood this and the consequences of this. I've been rereading Righteous Mind by Jonathan Haidt, and he's really talking about morality. What is it in a fundamental way? And he's trying to establish that it's really an emotionally based. And so he has experiments with people, like thought experiments, where they present you with a situation. Something's happening, people are doing something that's morally, that's repugnant, right? It's intended to like be repulsive. But they've framed it in such a way that there's nothing rationally, morally wrong. No one's being hurt. Everyone's completely choosing to do what they're doing. So there's no moral basis for saying that this is morally wrong, and yet almost 100% of the time people say it's wrong. And when the examiners ask, why is it wrong? And they'll say, well, because of this and this and this. And the experimenter will say, no, actually, you know, nobody's being hurt. They're agreeing to do this. Nobody's being forced. There's no harm being done. And then the person very often will say, well, I don't know why. It's just wrong. And then he's trying to say that's so deep within us. And it's deep in a very emotional sense. It's instantaneous. And that even our rational mind, which we think is so powerful, can't override that, can't undo that, can't sort of take that charge out of it. There's just a sense of it being wrong, and I'm sticking with that, even though I can't explain why. Which is kind of interesting. And so now let's think of being on this path of entangling, untying this fundamental knot that we call delusion, we call attachment, we call self-clinging, we call dukkha. We sit upright and we relax. You know, it's easy in meditation to think about different aspects of being cultural, or they're just stuff that came down to us, or they're not really that important. I thought of that before I came here, and I thought, keeping my eyes open, it was uncomfortable, it was difficult, so I just wouldn't do it. I didn't do it. And then I came here, and I heard my teacher, and the teacher say, keep them open, and I thought, why? Why does it matter? It seems so simple, so trivial, right? But I kept hearing it, so I thought, well, okay, maybe I should do that. And then I began to see the effect that it had. And so to sit upright in a posture that's awake, that is self-sustaining, right, and relaxed. So there's alertness and there's relaxed. Daojian said, relax the body, loosen the limbs, mind awake. I was reading that cognitive scientists have found that, and I'm going to quote here, the bodily sensation's role in developing and maintaining the most basic phenomenal sense of selfhood and body ownership. So that when we're moving, right, we're getting information that keeps creating, giving us a sense of I am, of selfhood, and that I, in ownership, this is my body. It's not just that there is a self somewhere in this body, but this body is me. It's mine. And the various senses and signals, like through the muscles and tendons and joints, they create a sense of body location, of position, proprioception, of locating ourselves in time and place. Also, cognitive scientists are finding creates a mental sense of self. Right? So it's not just a random thing that's arising. It's arising out of these very simple, very specific movements. Then he said, when there's no change in movement for a long period of time, there's no stimulation, there's no shift, then that sense of the body and self tend to begin to drop back. Quiet, calm, diminish, because there's no new information coming in to say, I am. I am in my body. This is my body. Here it is, which is what movement is constantly doing. And we don't have to have that thought to know it. He said the respite from the daily barrage of external triggers, daily life leads to reduced anxiety, increased relaxation, and a heightened interoceptive awareness. That is the sense of knowing what is happening within your body and mind. We call that mindfulness. One of the aspects of mindfulness, that when there's relief from all of the constant barrage of stimulation, visual, auditory, in every way, which our culture is pretty good at creating, that there's a sense of calming, right? And not just calming, but alertness, right? It's not calming into a dull state, which is very easy to do. In fact, it's almost the natural thing that will happen unless at the same time we're consciously developing alertness, wakefulness, which is essential in all forms of Buddhist meditation. Then it says, within a prolonged stillness, while in a state of alertness, this can lead to what he called a deconstruction of some aspects of our consciousness connected with language and conceptuality, yet without inducing a state of sleep. Wow! Right? So within a prolonged state of stillness and alert, we're not going to sleep, we're not shutting down, it's alert and still, that has a natural way of leading to a calming, not just of body in that sort of unarticulated sense of self, but actual thinking, language, conceptuality. The Buddha knew this, right? In a sense, his science was his mind, his inquiry, the alertness, the brilliance, I would say, of his particular mind, which was able to, with some help, guide himself into this kind of knowing. And then further, to not just have that sense of self fall away, but actually to realize that there is no self to begin with. And so now, what is turning the mountains, rivers, and great earth to return to the self? We normally think of dealing with our situation, whatever it might be, through activity, through thinking, through talking, through some sort of movement, through some sort of action, to get the world to change so that I am in the desired state that I want, having pleasure, avoiding pain. And so how much of our life and our energies are going into trying to control our situation, right? To turn the mountains and rivers and the great earth. Not to return to the true self, but to actually cling to, grasp at, continue to reify the sense of self. So the Buddhism recognizes that when we do certain things, we have one action leads to happiness, leads to pleasure, leads to joy, leads to satisfaction for a moment. See, that's the thing. One action, one happiness. One action, one satisfaction, and then it's gone. And so that's why to desire to be free of suffering and the root of suffering. So that heartfelt wish is not just to live in an ongoing state of impermanent, temporary, fleeting, fragile, unreliable, unpredictable moments of happiness, or whatever, you know, we want that's on the good side, but actually something that's much more pervasive, much more permeating, much more life itself. Dada Roshi said, responding to the myriad things from the perspective of the self is delusion. I want, I go out to get. And so in that, it just confirms, reifies, strengthens the sense of I, which is always happening within movement, which is always happening in association with language. So looking at what science is finding, then it's like meditation is like, what else should we be doing? Right? Like if we needed something to give us more confidence or faith or validation, and science is your thing, right? Science is what gives you that. Well, there it is. And not just meditation, but very particular aspects that are very much part of our training here. Sitting in stillness, right? Why is that? It's not just being uptight. It's about not being uptight. We come in uptight. It's through that particular discipline and almost, I mean, just think of the of sports, athletics, think of arts, like there's always a discipline where we have to train ourselves in something that in the beginning doesn't feel natural. It's not easy, right? We keep going outside the line, right? Going out of tune, missing the hoop, whatever it is, right? But then we train, and then that becomes more effortless. So in the beginning, training in the discipline is hard, right? It's difficult. But the more we do it, the easier it gets. And so at the beginning, just being still is difficult. Why? Because we've been in constant motion, which is not just motion, it's restlessness, it's agitation, it's anxiety. I mean, motion just sounds neutral. But our movements are most often not neutral. Even our stillness is often not really still. Think of just the impulse to fidget, right? And the difficulty of just not fidgeting, not scratching, right? Not shifting. It can be so strong. Sometimes, you know, how many people have been sitting here calmly, everything's fine, and wanting to jump out of their skin, right? Nothing's wrong. Nothing's happening. But internally, it can be so powerful. Just a state of stillness. And then to see how in that, is it because we're just restless and not used to it? Or is it in some deeper way because it requires that we actually begin to let go of the constant grasping, me, 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 me. And that's so disruptive. That's so uncomfortable. That we keep wanting to come back into movement, come back into some sort of motion, some into fidgeting. So it's like, okay, yes. Oh, here I am again. It's okay. Here I am again. It's not okay. Here I am again. And then the effect that has on the mind. And so we can be working so hard to try and concentrate our mind in a way that's too tight, too forced. We do have to apply effort. And what we have to learn is what kind of effort? Because if it's an effort that is actually, there's a lot of things in motion, right? My attempt to concentrate is actually moving a lot within my mind as I try and dampen down on my mind. That's just working against the very thing that I'm seeking. So isn't it interesting to look at these sort of affirmations from other fields? Responding to the myriad things from the perspective of the self is delusion. That sense of being lost, of being distant, of being separate from the self, from the mountains, from the rivers, from the earth, from self-nature, from each other. So naturally we want to return. That seems like a good impulse, right? That seems like our wisdom. Come back. Find our way back. To what, though? What does that mean? What does it mean to return? Because that's going to be based on certain assumptions of where we're going, where we started, where we're going, what it's going to be like when we get there. Who is it that's coming back? What are we seeking? What are we trying to return to? It's like my rain jacket. My rain jacket was never lost, right? It was always exactly where it was. It was lost to me, right? I've gotten lost in the mountains before, camping, hiking. There was some place I was going to. There was a track, a path, even when I was bushwhacking, that I was needing to follow, following my compass. And then I got lost, right? And that sense of I am lost is very quickly overwhelming because it's fundamental. I'm lost, right? But then when I stop and realize I'm right here, I'm not lost, right? I don't know where the path is. That's what's actually going on. There is a path, there is a direction, there's somewhere I'm trying to go. I don't know where that is. I'm not lost. And so to think about the power of language. So once in that one of those instances where I was lost and I stopped and I was panicking and running, looking for the path. Actually, I was looking for my pack, which I had put down to go watch the sunset. Couldn't find the pack. So I didn't know where the path was, nor did I know where everything that I brought with me was. So I'm running around and then realizing, oh, this is the thing they always talk about, don't do this thing that I'm doing, which is panicking. So I stopped and I thought, okay, I'm right here. I sort of evaluated my situation. I don't find my pack. I don't find the path. What do I do? And so I thought, okay, there's some things that I can do, right? I stopped, I sat, I built a fire, right? I calmed myself, and then I got up and I retraced my steps, which I had done before in a panic and did not find my pack, and I found my pack. So what is returning? We hear from the very beginning that we have Buddha nature. You can't return to it. Right? A cloud cannot return to the sky. Wetness cannot return to water. And yet there's the very real sense that we're distant. We are distant. We are separate. Our world, our troubled, beleaguered, blessed world is a testimony to what happens when we are lost. When we are lost to ourselves. When we are lost to ourselves, we are lost to each other. They happen at the same time. And so we practice to free our bodies and minds of our attachments, of our false views, of our sense of being lost, of being estranged from something essential. We are not lost. We are not distant from it. But we know the taste of that. I hope you do. Because when we taste that symptom, that sign of being lost, of our attachments, of our false views, that brings us into a state of wakefulness. Oh, that's what's going on. I am distressed, therefore I am grasping, therefore there's a self. What am I grasping at? Where do I need to release? Where am I not being wakeful? What am I not seeing? I'm looking, but what am I not seeing? I saw something there in the corner that looked a whole lot like my rain jacket, but it didn't. It didn't. So practicing the Dharma, we bring our bodies and minds into alignment. And that's why having an intention. We're so desire-driven, right, in ways that are constantly causing us to turn away from ourselves, that are causing, can so easily cause so much trouble. How about if you raise a good desire? A desire to not separate, to not distance. Every action that arises from anger and hatred and intolerance and bigotry is an expression, is a sign of being in conflict. I am in conflict with myself. I am experiencing something, but I'm not really in touch with it. I have not examined this. I am not close to this. I am not taking responsibility for this. And so I turn outwards. That's why Buddhism calls it a poison. And this kind of poison doesn't just stay restricted within this one body, but it gets spread. And so in the world, the sense of using anger and violence to gain peace is a path, but it's a false path. It doesn't bring peace. Not true peace. In the same way that pursuing one transitory pleasure doesn't bring true happiness. It may bring a moment of respite, but in a sense, that moment of respite is just preparing for the next trial. And the fact that going to war, for instance, seems easy and making peace is difficult is just because we've made it good to go to war. That's a habit we've reverted to over and over and over again. And so I often think if people in power could just decide, okay, we're at each other's throats right now, but the one thing we're not going to do is go to war. Just like try it. No matter what, we're not going to revert to that. Doors will have to open. In the same way that when we do not revert out of aversion to denying and ignoring, and we don't revert to distractedness, right? We will be in the presence of an open door. We will discover something. We don't have to know in advance what's going to happen. From ancient times to the present, people have regarded the myriad things as separate from themselves, not realizing that the universe is the body of the Buddha, this very body and mind. What does that mean? Right? It's the same thing as saying that your body and my body are the same. But wait a minute, you're over there. I see you. I'm looking at you, you're looking at me. You don't look like me. Right? We are different. The same body means the same nature. Empty. Empty of anything fixed. Empty of any eternal, permanent, self-existing need to fight over, need to defend self. That's the body and mind. That is the unified body and mind of each of us, of the Buddha, of the mountains, rivers, and the great earth. So Dada Roshi says, if you want to turn the self and return to the mountains, rivers, and great earth, so how do we return? Stop. Stop moving. Stop trying to fly away. Let the mind naturally come into a state of non-thinking. You don't have to know in advance what happens next. Your self-nature already knows. And what happens next is not something you need to know how to do, because it's not about doing. Isn't that a relief? So Dada Roshi says, if we want to return to the mountains, ask these questions. What do you see when you behold the mountain? What do we actually see? So when we look at something, can we see it? Right? Or are we just in a state of thought, projection, speculation, imagination? Can we actually just see with a mind that is not creating an idea of something? Can we see the real form of truth? What do you hear when you listen to the river sounds? Can you just hear the subtle gatha song of rock and water? To just see, to just hear. That's what training is. When you sit, you just sit. It's just this breath. When you walk, it's just walking. That's not just a practice of mindfulness. It is a practice of mind, but it is not just a practice of mindfulness. It is in that very moment. It's not even returning. It is in that very moment embodying the state of non-returning. In the Mountains River Sutra, the Dogen is talking about mountains being able to walk. He also says that they can rest. And he also says those who doubt that the mountains walk don't yet understand their own walking. It's not that they don't walk, but they just don't yet understand, have not yet made clear walking itself. If we doubt the completeness, the perfection of all things, that all things abide within their own Dharma state that is complete and whole and unhindered and fundamentally at peace, peaceful. If we do not yet see that, we just don't yet understand that that is also true within ourselves. It's the same. Same nature. It's not that the phenomena doesn't have those qualities, but we just don't yet understand that they do. We don't yet understand that we do. Not understanding, and without examination, we can just be quite convinced that things live in exact opposite states. Distant, distinct, threatening, conflicted, insufficient, problems that need to be fixed, problems that need to be sent away. But when we begin to see our original nature and the nature of all beings, we realize that is never going to bring anyone closer to anything good. In a way, it's sometimes we might wish that these fundamental truths that the Buddha realized and taught, but don't belong to Buddhism, by the way, at all. They belong to everything and everyone. It would be nice to wish that it wasn't so difficult to realize these truths for ourselves, right? Because then it would be much easier for people to live more peacefully, to not create so much trouble. And that's wishing for a world that doesn't seem to exist. But the thing to appreciate is not that this path is difficult or complex or takes a long time. It's just that our minds are a bit complicated, complex, and that's part of their brilliance, is the depth and breadth of consciousness, complexity, all that we are capable of. And learning how to hold that. You know, I think it's kind of like when you're a teenager and your body's like going, wow, right? Gaining its power, coming into its own. But our minds are sort of like kids, we're children. We don't know. We don't really understand what we're in the midst of. And so there's a lot of flailing and acting out and, you know. So there's no place to hide this true self, Dada Roshi says. When the universe disintegrates, it remains indestructible. This great body ultimately has no abode. It is a body of no belonging, of no possession. So what the Dharma, in a sense, is doing is just bringing our attention, calling for our attention. And if we follow this path, spending potentially the rest of our lives understanding what that is, to be called to attention. May we want to know.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.